side, and roughly how many watts do you think it's going to be able to transmit? Many of these satellites for amateur frequencies are downlink limited. In other words, they're fairly weak on the transmit capability, and therefore you have to have a pretty good antenna with a pretty good noise figure on the ground to hear them. So how many watts and what's the source of power? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW and the deck man.
Yeah, if you see them, they're all covered with solar panels. They're naturally a cube, and every side has solar panels. And then the antennas, ones I've seen come out, one of them came out like a switchblade, and the other one came out like a telescopic thing out of the side of it. So I guess each one has a little different design. And they're made in different colleges. Yeah, you probably even get probably a high school class. I wouldn't be surprised. And there's all kinds of these things being made. They've been doing it for quite a few years now, actually. And now with the International Space Station, with the system that they have, they can only do, I think, roughly, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 at a time, tops. And they can do it like three times a year. That's all they're allowed to open up on the Japanese module. So that is a movement. There's actually a company willing to pay. They'll pay whatever it costs to attach their little module to the end of node 3 on the space station called Tranquility. Because that's going to have an opening very soon once the PMA gets out of their pressure mating adapter, which is going to be used for docking of crewed missions. So you have an open port. They want to put theirs there, which will be another much bigger airlock for these, not only CubeSats, but for even bigger satellites. And because it's going to be bigger, a bigger door, you might say, they'll be able to bring in larger components from the space station, for instance. They'll help NASA out. NASA has something break. Might be a big pump assembly instead of going out and doing a spacewalk and trying to replace a valve setup that's bad. Bring the whole thing right through into this big airlock. They can't do that at this time. Back to that. Back to you, Dick.
I'm a little bit amazed that they made something as complicated as a telescoping antenna to come out of the side of the satellite, as opposed to something simple like a carpenter's metal tape that wraps around it and you release it and it springs out, which many of the early satellites use that. But I guess there's a very specific out-of-package of a CubeSat that's not supposed to be exceeded, and this tape measure wrapped around the satellite would come out of that envelope. So I guess that's the reason they weren't able to use that. Is that a pretty good guess, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I haven't looked into it that closely. So I've seen them putting them together, but I didn't pay that much attention to what I was watching. But I'll look into it. We should anyway. It's our amateur. A lot of them are by different companies that have nothing to do with amateur radio, but a lot of them do. We're looking forward to this beam project going up though next end of the month. I'd like to see the CubeSats. We'll have to get back to there's so many of them that have been sent up. I wouldn't even know where to begin. A lot of them by foreign countries, Japan, and who had one recently? Some country that didn't have anything to do with, Denmark, that's what it was. Denmark made one, and because they had their own astronaut going up there, they were so happy that he was able to release one of their satellites. There's a big demand for CubeSats. Everything got smaller. Thank you, Dick.
Paul, what's the approximate size of a CubeSat? I don't remember seeing a size stated, but when I look at the photograph of one of those, if I had to make a guess, I would say it's roughly a 1 foot cube, 1 foot on each side. Am I even close? Over to you, Paul.
No, they're all pretty much 4-inch
4-inch cube, 4x4x4. And then, you know, you could pay to have, you know, like I said before, they call it a bread box. That's 3 cubes. So that's a big one. But most of them are all single cubes. They'll get released sometimes 3 at a time. I've seen that, and then they separate. What bothers me is, to me, this is all clogging up the atmosphere, but they say so, not the atmosphere, space, but they say they're so light. I guess the word would be buoyancy, I'm not sure, but because of their weight and their size, they actually deorbit very quickly, you know, within a month or two. So, when I first heard about these, all I can picture is thousands of these things going around in orbit, you know, like we don't have enough problems. They do say they don't have much of a life. In fact, either.
4 inches square, 4 inches cubed. My goodness, that is small. Therefore, the total amount of solar power from those solar cells is very little. I'm led to believe these things can only transmit milliwatts if they're on the air for any substantial amount of time. Yeah, if you charge the batteries and make a brief transmission, you can make a stronger transmission. But I'm beginning to think the average power is milliwatts. And milliwatts from 200 miles up on any of the ham radio frequency, 2 meters, 440, 1296, 10 gigs, there's a lot of loss in that 200 miles. So you've got to have a pretty darn good ground station antenna to be able to receive the few milliwatt transmitters, in my estimation. Have any of the articles you were aware of, Paul, stated the approximate power output of these CubeSats of you, Paul, K2LAW?
No, I haven't seen that. Not I would have paid attention to it. If I saw it, I could look into it. I would imagine it's not much. And, by the way, I wanted to tell John if he puts in into the computer, you know, the ASDS, that's for the barges, they're autonomous spaceport drone ships. That's what they call them. And they give them names. You know, like this one was, "Of course I still love you." He takes the names from some science writer, and he's really into that. But you could research how much horsepower, tremendous amount of horsepower on these things to keep these things buoyant, you know, level. So it's pretty cool. And then after they land, this big support ship comes by, and they dock with the thing, and they go on board, and they're going to secure this rocket once it lands. Could you imagine doing that, by the way? Could you imagine climbing on this board, on this boat, and hoping that this thing doesn't fall over as you're working on it? And then what they have to do is eventually lower it somehow, because they have a crane on board, and then... fold up the legs, this way it'll come back laying down. Of course, we haven't seen that happen yet. Back to you, Dick. Any more on the CubeSats? I don't have that much on it.
No, for a second, I'd like to switch over to James Webb Space Telescope. I saw a YouTube video or something like that in the last week, showing you that they've created this robot-like device that takes each one of these very valuable, very precise panels. I think there's something like 18 individual panels that make the composite parabolic mirror, which is, I forget the distance, is it something like 18 feet in diameter is a mirror? So each of these roughly 1 foot square or even bigger mirrors are picked up by this robot-like device and installed into the frame. And when they're properly located in the frame and the whole thing aligns itself, I think each mirror has to be precisely positioned in that frame, in that exact address, to the nearest 98 microns or something like that. Very precise. So James Webb is coming along very nicely from what I can see. Well, I sure hope that goes well, because there's no repair procedure on that one. A million miles out, no astronaut can get there to do a repair. Just like no astronaut, let me drop. No astronaut is never going to go in a reasonable time from now to a synchronous satellite and do repair. you and I are dreaming about the fact that they could create a robot that visits a number of the synchronous satellites, and if it's got enough capability by remote control, it can do refueling and minor repairs, but you're not going to send an astronaut there. The space shuttle is never going above 600 miles. Its synchronous orbit is 22,300 miles. Way out of the range, way out of the capability. Much too expensive to get there. It would cost as much to put an astronaut there to do a repair as it would to put up another satellite. Probably another satellite is even cheaper. Just build another satellite. Throw the one you got away, so to speak. Put it up into the graveyard. So, James Webb is going to be doing some really great stuff. Brand new frequency region, much down, lower in frequency, which has got a lot more penetration of dust. We're going to see stars being born. We're going to look through the dust. We're going to look at black holes. We're probably actually going to see the surface of a black hole. Let me drop quick. With James Webb. So we're going to see things that whenever you build a new piece of space hardware, which has new range, new diameter, new sensitivity on a new frequency region, you're going to discover things you never expected. Hubble, as you can tell, the Hubble Space Telescope has discovered a zillion things that we never expected. You look at that ultra-deep field picture. Wow. Where you see 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before in this tiny little chunk of space that's a small fraction of the diameter of the moon. And that was a dark piece of space that looked like it had nothing there. It goes on forever. When you look out at the highest range of that ultra-deep field, and you don't see the stars becoming more sparse, you see almost the number of galaxies out there is not becoming more sparse. When the perimeter of your observable universe has a large number of galaxies, you have to be pretty naive to think, yeah, that's the end. There's nothing beyond that point. Oh, really? We're about to make some more. With James Webb, which is probably going to be able to see further. Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it's going to see further out. Further back in time, further out in miles, or in billions of light years. It's going to see things that we've never seen before. Let me drop them. So, from all we can tell, the latest estimate of James Webb, which I think is near the end of the year of 2018, I still think it's on schedule to be launched. Is that the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that'll be September of that year is planned, and that date hasn't faltered in probably the last 8 years since they've been developing it. This thing, of course, it used to be called the Next Generation Telescope before it had a name. That's when they were still working on Hubble in 1990 when that thing went up. So, of course, since then it got its name, and now find it, and it's really a design taken from the Keck telescope. The Keck telescope has Hawaii has their segmented mirrors there. You've got six sides on them, and because to make it out of one mirror would be so heavy, the gravity wouldn't cooperate in the mirror. It would have to be so heavy that you wouldn't be able to move it, or it wouldn't hold its shape. So it worked out so good for that, they said, well, James Webb will be the same design. So that is 18 mirrors, actually 19 if you consider, you got to reflect the light back to this other one, the secondary mirror. And that's roughly about the same size. So yeah, each six-sided piece is roughly about a meter. So the whole diameter is 21 feet. So if you stood that up next to Hubble's about 8 feet. So it's like three times the diameter. Of course, area-wise, it's much more. And that's they're big on beryllium. Beryllium has a very low shrinkage coefficient with the temperature. So they don't want the shape of the mirror to change. In fact, the whole thing is mounted on a beryllium alloy frame, so the frame can't change any dimension with heat changing. It's all going to be solar powered, no RTG on it. It has an 8-foot dish, parabolic dish to send the signals back to Earth from 1 million miles out. Compare that to Voyager, like we were talking about before. Voyager, which has a 3.7-meter dish. So it's like 14 feet, whatever it is, you know, 14-foot diameter thing. So this is all, only about 8 foot. That's all I need. And it's got a panel sticking off the end of it, which will act as a deflector of particles coming from the sun. They don't want the influence of the sun making this thing move, so this thing will actually act as a solar sail, to help stabilize everything. And of course, the tennis-size sun shield that we talked about before, that will open up five layers of it. It's like put five big bed sheets together and suspending one over the other and acting as a big sun shield. Now, it will have a 500,000-mile halo orbit. And I know it sounds like it's wrong, but it doesn't. It's twice the diameter of the moon. It will be floating around 1 million miles away from Earth, but it'll be in this large halo orbit, Dick. So that should be interesting. It's really orbiting about nothing. It's just hanging out at that area. That's where the gravitational forces are equal, centrifugal gravity with the Earth. Essentially, the James Webb will be really in a helio centric orbit, just like the Earth is. And it doesn't even have big gyroscopes on it. It has some kind of a vibrating gyroscope, like a bell type of thing. And it's eliminated the need for these heavy gyros to spin. They don't want it anyway. More problems than they're worth. They've had to change a lot of problems, a lot of gyro-related equipment out of the Hubble. They won't have to do that here. So, a couple of years, a little over 2 years from now, that thing will be launched. That should be interesting. And then after that, you have the W-1st, which is now being planned for a 2024 launch, something like that. So, and that's also going out to an L2. Originally, I heard there was going to be an orbital thing around Earth, you know, a highly eccentric orbit, like, you know, halfway to the moon or something, like Chandra. But no, now the W-1st is going to join James Webb out there. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N Space Report 191.
That little slipper on James Webb out to one edge, which catches the solar wind, by flipping it one way or the other, you change the amount of solar pressure that hits it. And that helps you stabilize the orientation of James Webb. And if it doesn't have these rate control gyros, these mass rotary things, whatever they're called, if you decide you want to change the aiming of James Webb, it was aimed to the east, and now you want to aim it to the south, if you know what I mean. You want to move it 90 degrees. I am guessing that motion takes a lot of time, but what does that steering pull? How do you aim James Webb? Over to you, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, I don't know yet, Dick. I know that it does have thrusters on board, but will they be able to... I know they'll probably be able to move that whole mirror. No, azimuth and elevation. They're not going to move the, let's say they have to point in one direction. It's all being covered up by that sun shield. That can't move. That's got to face the sun, for that matter, the direction of the Earth. And everybody thinks it's going to be in darkness, you know, behind the, you know, the shadow of the Earth. If they can't have that, they need the solar panels illuminated. So the sun will be always on James Webb, but it'll be on the back side of it. You know, it'll be covered up by these thermal blankets, protecting the not only the mirror itself, but the cryogenically cooled sensor. It does have some kind of regenerative cooling cycle. Yeah, sensor, you know, like, I don't know, I forget the number, 7 Kelvin or something, some very low temperature. But maneuvering, moving it one way or the other, I would imagine they have some kind of motors to turn this thing. I haven't seen that yet, Dick.
Yeah, I'm doing a calculation right now. The Earth is what, in the vicinity of 3 or 4 times the diameter of the Moon. So if you were 3 or 4 times lunar distance from the Earth in front of the Sun could give you a total eclipse. But James Webb is not 3 or 4 times. Moon is 250,000 miles out, 750,000 miles 3 times. So if you're 750,000 miles from the Earth, you can get a total eclipse. James Webb is 1,000,000 miles away from the Earth. Therefore, even if you're directly behind the Earth, you're not going to get a total eclipse. You're still going to see the Sun, a substantial amount of the Sun, around the perimeter of the Earth. Therefore, no matter what you do, the Moon can't shadow it, the Earth can't shadow it. Those solar cells are always going to be seeing nearly the same amount of energy. I mean, you can cut it down by 2 to 1 during a total eclipse. So, now, if the Sun shield, the 5-layer Sun shield, is always in the same direction toward the Sun, and if you want to aim James Webb in some other direction, I haven't seen the great big bearing that does that. If you took the mirror on James Webb and the focal point, and if all of that was mounted on a platform with a great big rotary bearing connected to the Sun shield, I could see how you could aim it in different ways. I don't think that bearing is there. I think you just simply aim the whole darn structure. And there are certain directions, let me drop. There are certain directions aiming in space you can't go, because you'd have to change the orientation so much. The Sun shield would be oriented in the wrong way, and James Webb would be looking at Earth or looking at Sun. That's a no-no. However, it's essentially in orbit around the Sun. It's 1,000,000 miles away from the Earth, always. But the Earth is in orbit around the Sun. So therefore, you wait for the right time of year, and therefore you can aim James Webb anywhere you want, as I see it. So you've got to choose the right time of year to get to certain directions along the ecliptic. North of the ecliptic, south of the ecliptic, you can go there anytime. But certain directions out on the edge of the ecliptic, you've got to wait for the right time of year. But I'm a little bit disappointed that this solar wind panel aiming technique was discovered this many years downrange. I guess it was the Kepler that they suddenly discovered they can do that. We could have been using that a lot earlier than this on Hubble and not burning up those gyros. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, well, they must have knew about it before Kepler, but, because it was designed into James Webb before they got the idea to utilize that same principle for Kepler. So I guess that, you know, time marches on. It's like this gyro thing that they have. I've read about it. I still don't understand it. It's some kind of almost like a bell type of situation. You know, it's some kind of electric, probably quartz type of thing to make something vibrate. And then lasers somehow are looking at this, and if it changes direction, the laser will pick up on it. Love to see the physics behind this thing. So, it begins with an H. I have it saved somewhere. Ilio something or other. But it's an interesting thing between that and this thing that's going to deflect it, make it move. Now that's the other thing. It always looks like the pictures I see. It looks like this thing is positioned in one position, 90 degrees or parallel, running parallel. The mirror is running parallel to the shade. So even if you're going to wait as you go around year after year, you could do that, but it would be nice to be able to point this thing. You know, say they it is. There's a quote.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Somebody gets the idea that there's a quasar and they won't be able to turn it quick enough to go look. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it works out. But yeah, I never saw any big actuators on it either. By the way, we didn't talk about it before. I don't, maybe you did. All these segments are going to open up. Everything has to be folded up inside the Ariane 5 rocket. So all these segments are going to have to open up, including the piece of the arms that come out that hold the secondary mirror, the tertiary mirror, the third one inside the, you know, where the detector is. That you don't have to worry about that, but the big part, the big mirror has to open up, and this mirror that's going to hang out at the front of it does. It's quite a deal. I saw a show, I think it was Channel 13, or I don't know what it was, 13, it was Science Channel. They had a whole big special on it. I think they said there's some 450 different pieces that have to move on this thing. And not one can fail.
I've seen a YouTube video of it being deployed as an animation. And boy, it does a lot of folding and unfolding. Like you say, a lot of squibs, a lot of actuators have to all fire and move at just the right time for all this to work. Now, when it comes to orienting, James Webb, you probably could move rapidly by using the thrusters, but you better do that very sparingly because you've got a finite amount of consumable fuel to do that. You've got to hold that in reserve. Other than that, I think you're going to spend most of the time moving slowly to reorient it. That's a guess on my part. It's about a large, massive thing with a big moment of inertia. By the way, from the Lagrange point, the Earth subtends a 0.45 degree angle, and the Sun is 0.5 degrees, so you never get a total eclipse of the Earth in front of the Sun at Lagrange point number 2. I did a quick approximation. It's not very accurate yet, but I can tell that you don't get a total eclipse. It's always going to have sunlight. Therefore, you always need that sunshade to protect the cryogenics. But being where it is, not very close to Moon or Earth, it's not getting very much local thermal energy other than the sun light, which that five-layer sunshield is going to keep away. Let me drop.
Oh, it's a 10-year mission. I meant to mention that before. Dear.
Very good. And so, maintaining a cryogenically cooled detector out there, as long as you can put the right kind of sunshield so that you're only looking at the background temperature of space, which is 3 degrees Kelvin. That's a beautiful cryogenic temperature. I think there is liquid helium on board, but I suspect it's going to be used up at a very low rate, keeping the detector cool. Is that the way you see it, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
You know, they have an active system, so it's, you know, it's the equivalent of a condenser and an evaporator system with helium, so that's why they're able to keep it going for 10 years. They wouldn't be able to keep it going, you know, they'd have to have very large tanks if they're going to bleed it off over time. So, I mean, helium's hard to keep contained anyway, but, you know, so I'm sure they have an accumulated type of tank, you know, any kind of reserve, but there is a regenerative refrigeration type of cycle that's going to be involved with this bacteria.
Is that cycle, is that called a Joule Thompson cryogenic refrigerator? Does it have a name like that?
Yeah, it does. And they, you know, if you look at the drawings, the schematics, they do show little tubing going up to the cryogenic focal point. You know, where the CCD is going to be, and the piping goes down through the sunshade, and it's going to dissipate the heat on the opposite side. Not that it's much heat, but, you know, every little bit counts, and the idea is to dump everything, including the all the electronics that are involved in this. They have their own heat radiators on the opposite side. The idea is to keep the mirror itself and the detector are as cold as possible, and that's why the mirror doesn't have a tube. But you know, the tube itself would have heat that would, you don't want
will the detector be held at the pole?
I remember putting that to my memory bank. I'm pretty sure it was 7 degrees Kelvin. 7. But, I mean, a quick search probably even on Wikipedia would probably tell me if my memory serves me right. I know it's very cold. I think it's 7 degrees Kelvin.
7 Kelvins, as they say. Okay, 7 degrees above absolute zero. That's just about the coldest thing we've ever put into space. That should make the detector nice and sensitive to infrared. So if this thing properly deploys, boy, that's going to see things. I made a discovery this week where I was really wrong. I'm not sure who brought it to my attention, but there is a website that gives you a millisecond by millisecond analysis with real live photographs of what happened on the Voyager, on the 1986, it's not Columbia. What's the name of the space shuttle that died in 1986?
Challenger?
That's the one, Challenger. Okay, then.
I sent that to you.
Yep, it was Joe. So it's the Challenger disaster. When you dig into the details of that movie that Joe sent to me, you suddenly see what really happened. The leak of that O-ring seal burned through all kinds of stuff, but it burned through the side of the external tank, which burned into the hydrogen tank, which deflated it, which eventually caused a failure of the oxygen tank, and so the explosion of the external tank and the disconnection of the solid rocket booster that got burned away, the attachment, the lower attachment, that all happened from that O-ring seal, where the hole under very high temperature pressure got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so of all the parts they recovered of Challenger from the sea, one of the things they recovered is the great big long explosive charge that goes along the side of the external tank in order to destroy it when you're through using the external tank, so that the great big thing doesn't come down in one piece on somebody's house. That explosive charge was recovered from the sea in one continuous, unexploded strip. So I had been saying for the last zillion years, I was saying that I thought the failure occurred because the flame created a false alarm of their own pyrotechnics. I've been saying that. Looks like I'm wrong. That pyrotechnics was recovered intact. Therefore, it was a disconnection of the lower support for the solid rocket booster pivoting into the external tank, creating even more damage, and the whole vehicle aerodynamically broke up after that. So the failure mechanism certainly was that leaking O-ring seal, and the one thing I have been saying is that the O-ring seal failed because of a mediocre design and a super cold day. And the super cold day was the second day of launch. They had to cancel the first day because they couldn't connect that damn handle that was on the shuttle door, because the bolts holding it there were cross-threaded and the hex key removal wrench stripped. And they tried drilling out the hole, but when they finally got the battery active drill motor up there, it was a discharged battery. Somebody had thrown down the electrically powered, the battery powered drill onto his desk one day and didn't bother recharging it. That's the one they picked up, and they brought it out to the pad. Let me drop it. With 20/20 hindsight, whoever ordered them to bring them a battery operated drill should have said, bring not one drill, bring three. Bring not one battery, bring three batteries. Bring a hand operated drill. Bring a hacksaw. Bring all of that on the trip out there. Then by one means or another, they would have drilled out the screws, they would have hacksawed off the handle, they would have done something to remove the damn thing, and they would have launched on the previous day, which was a much, much warmer day. And they had a super cold day that night that had freezing water and ice and everything all over that pad. They weren't even sure that the hold downs were going to be released properly because of all the ice that was built up that particular night. So that whole thing, and Krista McAuliffe would be alive today if that damn handle could have been removable. What a waste, by our current knowledge, as I see it. Over to you, Paul, for any comments on all of this. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, but sooner or later they would have had to try to launch in those temperatures. They thought they would, you know, they could do it, and they could have lost some future crew. They went in with a triple type of rings afterwards, a different kind of J joint that they had, where your redesign was practically impossible to allow any kind of passage. So I think it would have eventually happened anyway. And they also say because Reagan wanted to make that speech at night, he was going to make the State of the Union speech, and that was part of the going to be part of the speech that, you know, he's got a teacher up there, and there was a big push to get that thing off the launch pad. And I think this was the fifth try too, so they were getting frustrated, and they pretty much went, you know, call up one fire Kyle, let me drop it. One fire Kyle was even saying, you know, basically not a good idea, and they said NASA didn't listen to them. So a lot of problems, more than just a handle, a series of things went wrong, and including the design itself. And thinking about that company, One Dial Kyle, they changed their name. They originally was Dial Kyle, and then they got them out with One. It was One Dial Kyle at the time for that. And then they separated, and they eventually became ATK, and now it's teamed up with Orbital ATK. And they're actually still in business doing two things, sending the Cygnus spacecraft up to the International Space Station. And the same company, basically, you know, it's just a different version of the company. It's been bought out and sold so many times, but it's really the same people. They're building the solid booster rockets for the SLS system, for the new Orion that's eventually going to be going up. So they must have learned a lot from what went on there. In fact, he did.
And because of that booster failure, and the booster itself, the solid rocket booster, really is a NASA design. Martin Fiercoal, I think, only supplied the solid state fuel that goes into it, but that wasn't their fault. That O-ring seal. I don't think the O-ring was their design. I think that was a NASA design. And by the same token, the Hubble, when it was first launched, with the incorrectly shaped mirror, and that was done by Perkin Elmer, and that created quite a disaster at first, until Story Musgrave came along and did that beautiful repair and gave it a set of eyeglasses, so to speak, and has been doing great things ever since. But because of that failure at Perkin Elmer, I think Perkin Elmer has changed their name. It's probably the exact same factory in Connecticut with that very special skill they've got, but now they're operating on another name. Isn't that roughly what happened, Paul? K2LAW?
I know the name is gone, I know the building is gone. But, you know, whether they're like a submarine and come up with, under a different name in a different location, I don't know. But, you know, again, that's the specifications. You know, were they wrong, or was the specifications wrong initially? I don't know. And then as far as, you know, they did plenty of people on the board trying to figure out the Challenger problem. And they said pretty much everybody that was involved needed to make improvements. NASA needed to listen to the engineers more. The companies themselves needed to listen to the engineers more. You know, maybe some engineer would have said that this is a poor design. Now, things have all changed, of course, now, the way they're doing things. Let's hope they did anyway. But even after that, we had Columbia go down, re-entering the atmosphere, and that was 2003, so that was, what, 7 years later. With problems, there's always going to be problems. It's a risky business, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, nobody ever said that space travel is going to be safe, super safe. You're working with very exotic chemistry on those thrusting devices, very high velocities, very high energy physics, going high velocities through atmospheres and whatever during a launch, during re-entry. You know, temperatures like numbers 4,000 degrees on the leading edges of the craft. You're pushing the state of the art in a whole lot of areas. There's risk involved. Everything's got to be just right or you're going to get in trouble. Now, slightly different subject about space. If you and I were setting up a communication system between two separate satellites in free space, the higher the frequency, the better. If you go to higher and higher frequencies, as long as you can generate the power, you drop it. You can build a smaller and smaller parabolic dish, and you still get all the decibels of gain you want. You get a tighter and tighter beam at a higher and higher frequency. And there is no loss in space when you're going through a vacuum. However, you guys who know me well, I really believe in high frequency. I was one of the first guys on Long Island to be using 10 gigahertz way back in 1990, I guess it was. Had a lot of fun with it. I want to get back on that. But I'm dreaming about the frequencies even higher. Arguably, the guy who is the highest frequency ham radio operator in the United States is Brian Justin, WA1ZMS. He lives in Virginia. And he holds the distance record for 120 gigahertz, 243 gigahertz, 300 and some odd gigahertz, and 400 or 500 and some odd gigahertz. He has used all those frequencies on very similar hardware, and he holds the distance record in the United States. A couple of people in Europe broke a couple of his distance records, but he still holds a couple of those records. Let me drop them. But there's a slight problem when you're going through the atmosphere. A slight problem. Through free space, those frequencies have no excess attenuation. But when you got to go through the atmosphere, you get some very specific water vapor and oxygen line absorptions. And the water vapor absorption at around 600 gigs, I don't know the exact frequency, in the vicinity of 600 gigs, there's a water vapor absorption line such that if it's a medium-high humidity day, you get a huge amount of loss. If it's an extremely dry day, you get a hell of a lot less loss. So on that medium-high humidity day, at one of those frequencies near 600 gigs, you can get 40,000 decibels of attenuation per kilometer. 40,000 decibels. Okay? You boil that down to numbers you and I can feel for, it turns out to be 12 decibels of insertion loss, absorption loss, per foot. You set up these two antennas, 1 foot apart. And the moisture that's in the air in your room, beyond the free space loss, you've got this extra attenuation loss, the water vapor is sucking up that signal at the rate of 12 decibels per foot. Okay? Using good common sense, by ham radio techniques, you want to get the signal through, you use the maximum loudness technique. Pour on some more power, use a higher gain antenna. Let me drop. So at 600 gigahertz, with diode multipliers, about the best thing Brian Justin can do is generate something like a microwatt of power. It's about the best it can do. Maybe it's even a fraction of a microwatt. Let me round it off to a microwatt. So a microwatt of power is what he can use, and he's got distance records of, you know, 1.5, 2, 3, 4 kilometers, numbers like that. The ARRL says a real radio contact has to be some kind of a substantial distance, like a kilometer. I think they relax those rules a little bit when you're way up there at 600 gigs, but I think every one of his distance records that he holds is over a kilometer. Let me drop.
I have a question.
I'll pick up your question in a minute. Let me finish the statement. So that we amateurs would just use maximum loudness technique. Okay, if I'm going from a microwatt to a megawatt, in theory, with a pulse, I can generate a megawatt pulse. It's going to take some work. But in theory, at many of the frequencies I care about, I can generate a megawatt pulse. Can I do it at 600 gigs? No way yet. But someday we will. And I'm using a good-sized dish where I get 30 dB of gain. So a megawatt instead of a microwatt and a 30 dB gain dish, I can come up 90 decibels increase in signal strength. That's a lot. 90 decibels is, let me think. I think that's 1 billion to 1. Yes, I can increase my effective radiated power by 1 billion times. That's within the laws of physics, of things that you and I can muster. Okay, I make the signal 90 dB louder, and assuming that my transmitter and receiver are 1 kilometer apart, and because of the normal atmospheric water vapor, I'm getting absorption, excess absorption, of 40,000 decibels per kilometer. So I got a 40,000 decibel loss, and I increase the signal strength by 90 dB. Big number. I got 1 billion to 1 more power. What's my insertion loss now? I go from, I pressed the wrong button here. I'm going to recall it to the screen. There it is. I press recall. Good. I start off with 40,000 dB, and I subtract 90 dB from that. So my free space loss that used to be 40,000 dB just became 90,000, not
repeater, timeout.
It just became 39,910. It was 40,000 dB per kilometer. I got these two transmitters and receivers, 1 kilometer apart. I had 40,000 dB of excess attenuation. I go 90 dB stronger in transmitter. That's about as far as I can go. I've now got a loss of 39,910. No way, Jose. So when you've got these super high attenuations in decibels per foot, power doesn't do it. We've got to do something else. Let's see what Joe's got to say. W2LYY, KQI, W2LYY, Joe.
W2LYY, as far as you know, or I should say, let me rephrase it. As far as you know, what is the highest frequency that you have ever heard of somebody making an emitter of, or out of, to rephrase this the wrong way, constructing something to emit an RF energy wave? How high has somebody got so far? You mentioned 600 gigahertz. Has somebody got to 1,000? Has somebody got to 2,000?
Absolutely, Joe. When you're up at 1,000 gigahertz, they call it a terahertz. There's a microwave company in Massachusetts, can't think of the name of it right now, that'll build you a mixer that works at 2 terahertz, 2,000 gigahertz. And when it comes to lasers and optical equipment, and we're now into 500 terahertz, the optical frequency that your eye is operating right now, what is it? You and I, Joe, have a pretty good feeling for what is 600 megahertz. We know what 432 is. 600 megahertz, we got a feeling for what that is. Your eye is operating at a frequency 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz. It gives you a little bit of feel for what it is. So with lasers, you can generate super high frequencies. With a very fancy mixer techniques, 2 terahertz is sort of the threshold. And there's a big gap in between where it's very hard to get there. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1592. You listened to Space Report number 191. Be kind to each other this week. Enjoy this great hobby we've got. 70 for you all. And John, pass it over to KC2WGB. You got it, John. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, again, I'd like to thank everybody for participating and sending in the questions and some of the comments. And if all goes well, we shall return next week. And have fun. Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul. Everyone on the net. Remember, be kind. It's a hobby. KC2WGB.
Over to Paul. WS2N. You're going to tie the ribbons on, Paul. K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, 73 John. Dick, everybody that's been listening. We'll be back next week. And we'll be looking for some more exciting space launches or landings. 73, have a good night. Thank you.
tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 2001 with a release date of Friday, March 4th, 2016 to follow in 5, 4, 3.
Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Northern State from 347. How you doing?
Okay. I'm about to get onto the Meadowbrook, so I'll be quite a bit in front of you this morning.
Roger that. Yeah, just I got back from Florida last night around midnight. So getting up this morning was a challenge. But I'm ready to go. I heard you call on the digital, the DMR, but I'm in an area now that's in and out until I get up to the northern state. I'll probably check on to that in a few minutes. WB2 MSB, rolling.
Okay, I'm monitoring that DMR frequency. So if I hear you there, I'll switch over. In the meantime, how was the trip to Florida? Were you able to avoid the amount of contact that you wish to avoid?
I think it was about 90% successful. I was able to do that. You know, as you can understand, with my father-in-law, there are certain rules that have to be observed on Saturdays that I've found for the last 35 years to be somewhat difficult. So sometimes happiness involves finding a place where I can go hide with a cigar and a book. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know much about your father-in-law, so I don't know what rules he has, but hiding with a book, I wouldn't mind. The cigar, I would stay away from. Oh, please.
Good morning. WB2MSB here.
That was Richie. N2ZEP to N2PPN. Please. Really? Oh, my God.
Good morning. N2PPN. Some people call me Maureen. Over to you.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Well, I did have a lot of fun with the DMR down there. It's different to be in a geographic location where you can pretty much hit anything you want because everything's flat. And also, the machines all seem to be working. The only one that was down that I had programmed in was the Boynton Beach DMR, but I was able to replace that with the Boca machine. So everything worked out fairly well, and a lot of chatter, a lot of people on the air down there. Go ahead.
Richie, just because I don't have the affinity for cigars that you do, doesn't make me a bad person. I just don't like smoking.
Smoke and a pancake, a blinks and a bong. That's what life is all about, my friend. As a matter of fact, I'm going to a pancake breakfast, I think, this weekend. I gotta check my calendar. This weekend in Seaford, a pancake breakfast to help support the Long Island Roller Rebels, all female roller derby teams. Yes. Gotta go help support the girls and be an athletic supporter. Maury?
Well, that sounds like fun. I thought all roller derby was girls. I thought that was a girl sport. Is there any boy roller derby teams? I don't know. Gary, what do you think?
I don't know about the modern roller derby, but when I was a kid and I used to watch roller derby Saturday nights on WOR-TV, there were men's games and there were women's games, and the women were more violent than the men.